Danny, you've just released, haven't you, the annual report about the work of the Safeguarding Commission and the Safeguarding Advisory Service. Can you outline for us, first of all, where you think most progress has been made over this past year?
Yeah, I think there would be three areas in particular that we would reflect on as having made positive developments. One was the work with religious orders and religious communities, to the point now where the vast majority of religious orders and communities in England and Wales have decided to ally themselves to diocesan safeguarding commissions rather than be separate. Those religious orders and communities that want to have their own safeguarding commission, which is absolutely fine by us, will have to meet the same criteria that we would expect of a diocesan safeguarding commission in terms of how they set it up and being audited as well by us. That's a significant development in terms of one church, so that we don't have a kind of disparate sense of safeguarding, but it's much more cohesive and much more gives that a sense theologically of one church working in this area.
It's also very important, isn't it, because some of the recent scandals that have come to light have been within these religious congregations or their schools.
Well, that's right, yes, and that's been quite important too. I mean, I've done some work. I've attended a meeting of the Executive Advisory Group on Safeguarding for the Conference of Religious, and one of their members, in the light of what emerged at Ealing Abbey in relation to the school, has drawn up very clear guidelines for any communities that still have schools and trustees for absolute clarity about the governance and actually separating the governance of the school out quite distinctly. So, yes, you know, there's been a good learning curve from that that's had to take place.
Another area that you've been focusing on over this past year is the ongoing pastoral response to victims, isn't it, and survivors?
Yes, that's right. That's been difficult this year. We have a subgroup of the commission which meets with representatives from victim and survivor groups. And then two members of that withdrew when the Portsmouth case for vicarious liability went to the courts here. They felt that was against the spirit of what the church was saying about how it was dealing with victims and survivors. However, I've attended my first meeting of that subgroup and have offered to chair the subgroup with victim and survivors groups. And that's been welcomed and accepted. And I've also volunteered to meet with the individual groups, including those who left our subgroup, just to maintain and continue dialogue with them, because I think that remains very important. It needs to be said, while the Commission understands that the issue of vicarious liability is a legal one, it's the perception of victims and survivors that that case for Portsmouth about vicarious liability is linked to a case of alleged abuse that they found difficult. So it's a perception issue.
So you feel there is room for progress to be made on this one, do you?
Yes, I mean, I think the appeal court made a judgment 2 or 3 weeks ago saying that the bishop was accountable for any priest in a parish, so vicarious liability held. It was a 2-1 judgment. We have to wait and see whether Portsmouth Diocese decides to leave matters there and accept that, or to go to the Supreme Court for an absolutely final judgment on the matter.
As part of the response to victims and survivors, you're developing what you call a care pathway, aren't you? Can you tell us what this includes and how well that is accepted by survivor groups?
Adrian Child, the director of our Safeguarding Advisory Service, has done most of the work on that. And actually, all along the way, has been working with representatives of survivor groups in terms of what a care pathway would look like. And one of the things that's emerged from that is we've just produced a leaflet that we want to be available in all parishes and all dioceses, which is for anybody who may have been a victim of abuse as to how they can deal with that, where they can go, what they can do. So again, being pastoral and being supportive quite openly and saying, you know, this is what you can do. Because very often people still don't know what to do. They're so traumatised by the experience, they're at a loss as to what to do, as to who they can trust. So part of the care pathway is to put steps in place where people know what they can do, where they can go, and how they can be supported. And that work will be, you know, will carry on into next year. And we'll continue to dialogue and work with survivor groups to ensure that it is, you know, sound and secure in that way.
You also had a conference earlier this year about the long-term impact of abuse, didn't you? What conclusions did this come to?
I think that, and that was before my time, I mean, I think that was just helping, opening up to people that the implications long-term for people who experience abuse and how long, you know, how that remains part of the life forever, but actually how long it can take healing to take place. I mean, at my interview for the role, when they asked me why I was interested in the post, I gave a number of reasons, but I actually referred to my own experience of having a friend who shared with me that he'd been abused by a priest at the age of 12 at the junior seminary we both went to, and he got his life together when he was 45. You know, and that's a rude awakening for some people, you know, that it might be 30, 40 years before somebody either gets a life together or does something about the whole impact. So I think part of that conference was trying to help people understand that safeguarding is not an issue to be sorted. It's something that's ongoing. And I think that's also why we push a sense of the theology of it. It's not about, here's an issue for the church to sort out, but rather, here is something where we theologically have to engage and deal with it. And safeguarding and protecting children, young people and vulnerable adults is part of our ministry and vocation as Christians and as Catholic Christians, you know, and a part and parcel of the integral life of the parish or the religious community in that way.
Do you feel this attitude has really been fully accepted now by bishops, priests and people rather than just by you working there on the front lines?
Well, although I was only appointed in March, I attended the Bishops' Conference in April, and I had a full 75 minutes at the Bishops' Conference with all the bishops present. The Papal Nuncio was present because he was speaking to them after my session. So I had proper time to engage with them, to discuss with them aspects of our work as a commission. And I didn't feel anything less than fully welcomed and fully supported by the bishops in the work that the commission was doing. I think the interesting aspect of my role is it's independent. Some people have difficulty, that was raised this morning at the press launch, you know, how can you be seen to be independent, you know, when you're appointed by the president of the bishops' conference and the president of the conference of religious. But actually in the 3 months I've been doing it, I felt entirely free to be independent, take a view about things, whether I'm in conversation with a bishop or working with others. So I feel that independence is actually understood and respected, you know, by the bishops within diocese. I wouldn't have taken the role unless I felt I could work independently.